and so that much of the evidence would have disappeared. Now, in terms of an evolutionary framework, adaptationist framework for a theory of art, the notion of a biological function, strictly defined, is that it is the function a mechanism was designed to solve by virtue of its past successes. So there's no reason to believe that the culturally elaborate graphic and narrative arts that we find in the Orientation have a biological function in this technical sense. They're simply too recent. There's no theory that would suggest that the act of making these objects would confer a selective advantage. So the suggestion is that artistic behaviors belong in a category of behaviors that do have a biological function related to self-construction, and that the graphic and narrative arts are cultural elaborations of these basic adaptive behaviors. The visceral functions that underlie artistic behavior may not be obvious from its subjective phenomenology. This may not be available to introspection. The proximal reasons that we enjoy art need not correlate closely with the effects that art has on us. In other words, art can affect us in ways that we are not aware. Furthermore, behaviors that were adaptive in the past will not be adaptive today. And while being guided by the aesthetic and imaginary pleasures of art, artistic behaviors in the past, on average, would have been adaptive, it was not necessarily adaptive in an individual circumstance, of course, and there is no need to believe that it would be adaptive today. So, for instance, if these adaptations make us watch television, there's no reason to think that television somehow does wonderful things for us. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't, but this doesn't follow from the theory. This has to be investigated independently. Right? So, the notion of cognitive function, then, is that the organizational mode hypothesis may be useful for accounting for the motivational component for art and for elements of the cognitive architecture, specifically those relating to learning. And I'll now go over the three functional hypotheses. One, visual aesthetics. Second, art as simulation aids. And third, art as a strategy for molding other minds. Let's see. So the suggestion to tie together the discussion on chase play and the capacity for mind reading, the suggestion is that the act of pretending that someone else is a monster, that you are in danger, involves very elementary forms of mind reading, elementary from our point of view. These are still sophisticated capacities. Once the adaptation for running fictional simulations are in place, and the machinery for source monitoring is established, making these basic distinctions, the system can also be used in the executive mode for modeling minds. I don't want to make this claim very strongly. It could be that, you know, even before chase play came very far, or these simulation pedagogies were very far developed, there was independent adaptive pressure for modeling other minds, competitor-prey situations, for instance. No doubt that these things were going in parallel. I do want to claim, however, that it's likely that selective pressure for modeling other minds was likely very strong through much of our much of hominid history, the last couple million years. If we can move ourselves imaginatively back to the Stone Age, we're not simply talking about modeling the minds of other people, which would of course have been important, people in our family, the people we're friends with, enemies with, but we also have to see humanity situated in nature in a completely different way than we are now. And the minds that human beings at the time needed to deal with were in large part animal minds. Population densities would have been very low, and animal densities would of course have been quite high. The the representations, the creatures depicted in Paleolithic art are almost without exception animals. Very few people, no sceneries, right? Possibly occasional things like the Pleiades, but this is speculative. Massively animals, large animals, right? Our kind of size, not mice and sparrows, right? But big cats, horses. And cows, aurochs. And these are stunning artistic creations. These are not simply primitive attempts at reproducing or merely hinting at something. These are elaborate and very thoughtfully designed images, and we'll now look at some of the logic behind the particular design. I'll skip this one. So, just a quick notion here that a sort of working initial theory of why people in the Pleistocene were interested in actually painting objects has to do with the notion of an external visual spatial manual sketch pad. Now, one view of this would be Merlin Lonhart suggested that that Paleolithic painting functioned as an external storage device, an exogram. That allows humans to circumvent the limitations of biological working memory. There are ways in which this may be true, but of course this is not storing narrative historical information, right? It might, however, be storing elements of visual processing. Al Cheney has suggested that externalizing the image by drawing a picture would reduce the demands on working memory and allow cumulative image to develop without a loss of information on components out of attention. So, in this view, forms of art are technologically assisted forms of contemplation. And we'll now be looking at, exploring a little bit more in detail this view, what kind of processing may have been going on. So the first hypothesis then is that Pleistocene art experiments with how to think visually, and the point is not simply to remind you of, you know, that this is, you know, think of a rhinoceros or something, but it explores in detail a possibility space of cognitive compression and an intelligent compression that that emphasizes salient details and pays less attention to things that are less salient or less crucial. Artistic techniques include things like the use of occluding contours. So this is especially with the early art. This is the dominant feature. You get the outlines, and you get especially the cervical dorsal outline, the head, the neck, and the back. You also get analytical decomposition, where the outline is presented at the angle at which it is most clearly distinguished. So, for instance, the torso is seen in full portrait, the antlers, the heads are seen at three quarters in a half portrait. You also get effects like mismatched sizes of body parts, it's as if you're zooming in Photoshop.